Maybe that's reasonable. Maybe a 1% origination. Is that, I wonder if that is on the table. I know that I had heard some people talking about that concept.
Well, Norway didn't follow that path, Jason. What Norway has instead proposed is an exit tax. According to BDO Global back in about a week ago.
Yeah. You're staying.
So this tax, by the way, is 37.84% on unrealized capital gains if you leave the country.
Oh my God. So they put a gun to your head.
Yeah. So it's a total disaster. Like, instead of, you know, seeing a bunch of their top taxpayers leave, all the entrepreneurs being like, hey, this makes no sense, you know, tax us, but please do it when we actually have or make money. So instead of being like, hey, maybe we should just like make some reasonable adjustment, they like double down. So basically what's happening now is like, you have to leave before you start a company.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Squarespace. Turn your idea into a new website. Go to squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use offer code TWIST to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Open Phone. Create business phone numbers for you and your team that work through an app on your smartphone or desktop. Twist listeners can get an extra 20% off any plan for your first 6 months at openphone.com/twist. And Dev Squad. Most dev agencies only offer developers. Why? Because product management is hard. Get an entire product team for the cost of one US developer, plus 10% off at devsquad.com/twist.
All right, everybody, welcome back to This Week in Startups. I am your co-host, Jason Calacanis. I'm an angel early stage investor here in Silicon Valley, Austin, and New York, but based in Austin. Now, you can join me if you have two or three friends and you want to start a company, go to founder.university. We run it three times a year, 250 teams, and we invest in about 10% of those, 20% of those. We'll give them their first check to incorporate. We love investing in startups, and with me, my co-host, Alex Wilhelm. You probably know him from Crunchbase, Mattermark before that, and TechCrunch. He is a deep knowledge expert on the technology and finance spaces. And we're going to run through your top tech news three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, typically this week, Monday, Tuesday for the holiday week. Alex, how are you doing, sir?
I'm actually fantastic because I'm looking forward to overeating and becoming a couch potato on Thursday and Friday. Don't call me because I will be on the couch unconscious.
I love it. Love it. I am in New York, my hometown with my brother. I'm in upstate New York hanging out here. I went to the Giant game yesterday and watched the abomination of a football team play another abomination of a football team. And we tailgated. I've had, my dad's had season tickets since the 70s.
Wow.
And so I think I paid for the PSL, you know, this per seat license when they make a new stadium.
Oh, yes. Yes,
but
yes.
You know, that was like 20 years ago. I haven't been to a game in like 20 years. I've been in California. It's never worked out. So I go and, you know, kid from Brooklyn, it's a big deal to have season tickets. Yep. You'd always tailgate for the games. Tailgates, when you drive your car, you park in the parking lot, you drink and you eat, yeah, you know, heroes from Diker Heights, you know, like big Italian subs or whatever. Sometimes you get a grill going. So I went, it was freezing. It was freezing.
Yes.
And I'm like, my God, it's so cold. And they're like, it's 50 degrees. What are you talking about? It's not cold. Have another beer. Shout out to everybody who had the Giant game. And it was just a miserable, terrible game, incredibly cold. And I'm like, well, at least I get to see the new stadium that, you know, my dad had always had good seats. He had 12th row, like just off the end zone. Wow. It was just amazing seats. But the, you know, these bastards did this PSL on him and, you know, it was a lot of money, like 10 grand, 5 grand a seat. So I'm like, at least I get to see the great stadium, worse than the old stadium.
Really?
The worst stadium I've ever been to. You know, you start going to Chase Center and you start going to these new stadiums. Uh-huh. I was at UT's game. You know, this is not like some, you know, it's a college football arena. I mean, unbelievably gorgeous, tons of amenities.
Uh-huh.
Disgraceful. Disgraziad.com for Disgraziad for the Giants stadium. The Meadowlands still remains one of the worst places on earth you can go. I understand we're going to have the World Cup there as well. So, in advance to the rest of the world, coming to America, the Meadowlands is not representative of the best of America. It's representative of the worst of New Jersey, and New Jersey's pretty much considered the worst state in America. unfairly, because there's some beautiful parts, but
there are.
You literally are going to the worst place in what most people joke is the worst state. So
it's we're not hosting putting the World Cup best, there, if you will. I have to say the Giants got smoked. I'm not shocked by that. The Eagles, however, won and are now 9-2. So if you are an Eagles fan, go Birds. We're looking pretty good for a team that no one actually believes in.
I think we're the opposite. I think we're 2-9 and the Giants. We're 2-8 or something terrible.
Look, at least you're not the Patriots, who are still dealing with having gone from the, well, they were the dynasty, and now they are the laughing
dynasty,
stock.
Right?
Yes. Yeah, well, look, I'm not a Patriots fan. I don't have a dog in that fight. Anyways,
I mean, let's call it what it is. They cheat. Anyway.
Yeah, they're the Astros of the Northeast, if you will. Anyways, on today's show, big show. We're talking to Dune's CEO about the impact of taxes and how that deals with basically startup formation across Europe. Jason, he'll be up first. Then MicroStrategy and the Bitcoin trade. What is Michael Saylor doing? Is it genius? Is it going to fail? We'll talk about that. Then on the lightning round, quick thoughts on OpenAI building a browser. What's going on with Blue Sky, the burgeoning IPO cohort of next year? And if we have time, the cost of AI in human terms. But let's start with Dune CEO. Jason, this was an interesting conversation about taxes, Norway. How did this catch your eye?
Well, it was something trending on X where Dune CEO is just talking about having to pay taxes on unrealized gains and the impact this has on startup founders. As you know, you can become incredibly wealthy on paper when you are at a private company, and you could have no access to that wealth. And if you have to pay taxes on it, you could be in a very strange situation where you're forced to sell an illiquid security. And we've had this discussion in America a number of times on taxing unrealized gains.
Mm-hmm.
Wealthy people, you know, you can be the CEO of a giant public company and you've got $1 billion in stock or $100 billion or anything in between, and you can take loans against that, never sell the stock. The stock keeps going up. And this happens in 0.01% of the cases in startups. And so it can look a little unfair. You're getting loans against your stock. You never sell the stock, so you never pay taxes. And so people get very confounding. Well, this person owns essentially a house that's worth a lot of money that they built. They still live in it. They've taken a loan against it, but they never pay taxes.
Uh-huh.
It's only when you sell those shares that you do pay taxes. Now, for rank and file, or for every other company, you probably fail. That's the majority outcome. That's the default for startups, is you fail, and that equity becomes worth zero. The people who invested in your company and they put $10 million in, they take a loss on that $10 million, and that's called capitalism. Is people build these companies constantly. People get equity in them, and the default is they go to zero. So let's bring in the CEO here, and we'll just walk through the example here of what happened to Frederik.
Yeah, so Frederik Haga is here, and I have to say, I have a fanboy moment, Jason, because I'm a big fan of Dune, his company, because it is essentially a repository of endless information on all things Web3. And so if you are a chart dork like I am, it's essentially Candyland. So Frederik, thanks for being here, man.
Thank you so much, and thanks for those kind words.
Yeah, explain to us what happened to you and how taxes, wealth taxes, paying taxes on unrealized gains works in the Nordics, in the EU.
Yeah, for sure. So maybe I could just start quickly explaining sort of the situation in Norway. And, you know, basically, I think Norway was more or less like a middle of the pack in terms of economic prosperity in Europe. Type of situation in mid last century. In 69, Norway found oil. So great, right? And then a lot of countries really mess up finding a bunch of resources, right? You know, some few people will like capture all of it, whether it's corrupt politicians or some elite that really just like gets all the profits. Norway has been like managing this really well for like half a century. So basically what they first did, like the politicians essentially did like two genius moves. So one was, at the time Norway found oil, there was no expertise in the country. So we understood, or like the politicians understood, like, you know, we need to build up the industry and get people in here to help us, international companies. But they also understood that like Exxon and Shell taking all the profits of this is sort of not a great deal for the Norwegian people. So they've started taxing the oil companies on 80% of their bottom line. So very aggressive tax, but, you know, you get to drill the oil on Norwegian territory. So that was like a brilliant move, because then the like Norwegian people benefits from this amazing, you know, valuable resource.
And Frederick, just to be clear here, that is the source of wealth that has led to Norway having essentially a $1.7 trillion sovereign wealth fund, yeah?
Exactly, yes. So
the largest in the world. And they just announced last year that they were going to engage in venture capital and maybe private companies, which I think everybody was waiting for because they were in public equities.
Considering it. Yeah, considering it.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by our friends at Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for you to build a beautiful website and for you to grow your business. Whether you're starting out or you're scaling up, Squarespace is going to make it easy to create an incredible website that engages your audience, allows you to sell whatever you need to sell, products, content, or even your time, all in one place. And here's what makes Squarespace a game changer. First, their new design intelligence feature. This combines two decades of design expertise with cutting-edge AI to help you craft a stunning personalized website in just minutes. There'll be no other website like it. Basically, it's Squarespace putting a high-end designer right at your fingertips. And second, Squarespace Payments. This makes managing your payments seamless with fast onboarding and support for popular methods like Apple Pay or Klarna. You'll be up and running in no time at all and ready to take payments however your customers prefer. And that's what you want to do. Meet your customers where they are. Finally, built-in analytics. Hey, if you can measure it, you can manage it. And the built-in analytics at Squarespace are second to none. It's everything you need to scale, from understanding your sources of traffic to understanding sales trends. Squarespace is going to deliver insights that help you drive growth, all fully integrated, all for the same price. Here's your call to action, squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/twist to get 10% off your first website or domain purchase. That's squarespace.com/twist. Make sure you go to that URL so they know you listen to the pod.
That was essentially the second genius move, right? So this oil fund now owns like 1.5% of the all the stock in the world. So it's like a pretty massive thing. And basically in the 90s, the politicians, even understood that the revenue from the oil industry that was coming in was so massive that they couldn't responsibly spend it on a running basis over the budget. And that's when they set up the oil fund. So, very impressive, like austere sort of forward thinking,
The opposite of America. Like financially responsible. They have a massive surplus and the is it 5-10 million people in Norway? It's one of the smaller Nordics.
Five-ish.
Yeah. So you have $1 trillion, 5 million people. It's a lot of money per individual citizen in this fund. And do people get like some benefit every year from it? Do they get a small stipend or a distribution? Or do they just get to live in a country with incredible healthcare and low taxes?
Not low taxes, but you get good healthcare, right? But so basically the way it works is so this is also like very impressive from the politicians. Essentially what they said is like, we'll only take profits from the fund and we'll fund state operations on that. So it's basically a rule that says 3% is the max or like the average that we will spend. So in theory, if we have 3% return on it, it will go on forever because you never draw down from the fund, right? So very impressive, and there's broad political support to do this, and they've been doing it for like 20 plus years. However, basically now the whole thing is like sort of catching up to the country and the politicians a little bit. Let's just pause that for a second. Basically, you have great oil wealth, but you also have a lot of oil industry, and like the whole economy is extremely oil-oriented, sort of in terms of the companies being built and whatnot. And then, of course, like oil will not go on forever. There's climate things, and you don't know how long it's going to be in the ground anyway. Everybody's starting to acknowledge that like, oh, actually, we need new companies and different types of companies, not just oil companies, right? So just to take our story, me and my co-founder, we started doing in summer 2018, crypto. We're a crypto data tool. We make it super easy to analyze anything happening on the blockchain. And basically when we started, this was not a cool, hot sector, right? It was like after the ICO bubble had popped and people basically thought the thing was dead. So we had to hustle like extremely hard. And coming from Norway, pre-COVID, all these things, like, you kind of like nobody's from nowhere. And in an industry that not a lot of people thought much about, right? So basically, we spent like over half a year with no salary. We had no money at all. If we traveled, we shared hotel rooms, just kept it extremely lean and scrappy. And then we managed to like raise some funding. But still, like we went over 2 years, just the two of us. Like we didn't hire anybody. We had like 40K salary after we raised some funding. Basically, you know, really, really hustled. And then with COVID and like the new 21 era, you know, we really had the right product in the right market and grew a ton. And suddenly we were able to raise a bunch of VC money. So we basically raised our seed series A and B in just over a year. So suddenly we went from like, you know, very small and scrappy to, you know, big company in a way, right? And basically then we have a very strong balance sheet because we raised $80 million. And what happens then is basically Norway has this wealth tax.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're like, you know, if you're an oil company, if you do real estate, things like that, like you can have debt, you can do various things so that you don't have cash necessarily, you have, you know, other things on your balance sheet. And so for some, it's always been sort of, call it annoying, but for some people or some industries, you can kind of cope with it. But then for us, suddenly we have like this balance sheet full of cash, which obviously we're going to burn and we're a startup and, you know, we're loss making all these things. And we're faced with a wealth tax bill on the cash of the company. And that's a 1% tax. And if you're not public, it's on the balance sheet. So if you're public, it's on the actual market cap of the company on the 31st of December every year. But if you're private, it's the balance sheet. So essentially, we had a strong balance sheet and they multiply that by our ownership share, even if we just have common shares. And then by 1%.
So if you have 100, you had 80 million in the bank, you own 50% of the company or 40% of the company, you get a tax bill every year for $800,000, 1% of 80 million, something to that effect. And then you're responsible for half of that, 400,000 or whatever, 40% of it, 300,000, something in that range. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, sort of ish in sort of the logic is right. And so basically, we were about to face wealth tax bill of like a few times our net income, essentially. You know, we made something around the ballpark of $100,000, and this was like multiple $100,000. So, you know, it's absurd. And then at the same time, around the same time, there was like a new, more left-wing government, and they actually cranked up the rates on the wealth tax, on the dividend.
Can I clarify? Because I was doing a lot of prep on Norwegian taxes before today's show. That was when they raised the wealth tax percentage from 0.85% to 1% if you have a net worth of less than 20 million krona, right?
Yeah. So you can subtract, you know, $2 million-ish. If you have less than 2 million, it's not counting. But basically, they cranked up the dividend tax and the wealth tax at the same time, which was essentially an effective doubling of the wealth tax because you have to take out dividend to pay for the wealth tax. And so in 2 years, Norway actually lost 100 of their top 400 taxpayers, accounting for 50% of the wealth. Of the top 400.
So wait, where did they all go? They just left town?
I mean, it's like Atlas Shrugged, essentially. You know, people disappear. But everybody goes to Switzerland. And the reason for that is Switzerland also has a wealth tax. And so for sort of tax treaty reasons, you end up in Switzerland because then you pay a wealth tax, which is lower and differently sort of set up, but still a wealth tax in Switzerland.
And the way taxes work in Europe is you pay the taxes of where you're domiciled, as opposed to in America, Alex, if you were to leave the country and still remain a citizen of the United States, you still get charged your federal taxes. So no matter what you do, the American government will make you pay taxes. Whereas if you're in a lot of European countries, wherever you move to, you pay the taxes there, which kind of makes sense, but America will follow you around the world. You will not have to pay state taxes, but you're going to have to pay your federal no matter where you are.
I think at least America is like one of the biggest talent and capital magnets of the world, right? As opposed to a lot of countries in Europe. So have a bit of a different.
This wealth tax continues, I assume, in Norway, even though they have this massive amount of wealth from oil that they found offshore that they've been slowly pulling out of the ground. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is kind of like the paradox, right? Because obviously, the state has a lot of money. It doesn't need. So the wealth tax is like less than 2% of the budget. And you could have easily like improved, you know, the corporate tax rate is like 22%. You know, make that like 24, 25. No one would have left the country because of that. But they're very ideological and very strong, like socialist ideas, right? And to some extent, I think it's like great that the oil fund can provide healthcare and education and these things. I mean, it's a fantastic thing. The problem is that they have so much money from the oil wealth now that sort of the sitting politicians kind of just assume money grows on trees, right? They don't really care if so many people leave. They're just like, hey, we have to tax the rich. So we have to have these taxes, even if they don't make sense, even
now,
if people are living in
mass.
Now,
what's the wall of shame? There's some wall of shame going on now? Explain that to us.
Yeah, so this is kind of the crazy thing with the story is like I personally like I did some opinion pieces. I called out like, hey, you know, I can't pay this tax. It's many times my net income. There's like no one can answer me as to how I'm supposed to do this. But what made this story go kind of viral was the Socialist Left Party were interviewed in their offices in Parliament actually the other day. And turns out they have like a wall of shame, which is like newspaper articles on people criticizing the tax system. So my face was on it. So basically, I'm on the wall of shame. Yeah, here you go. So I'm on the wall of shame for having criticized, you know, the tax regime.
Code. Yeah.
Yeah. And no one has ever, told me how I'm supposed to pay this tax, but you get this.
Well, I mean,
stuff.
In
so
terms of paying the tax, if the company was sitting on $80 million in investment, I guess what would have to happen is you'd have to give shareholders a dividend of the money they just put in. That dividend would then have to be prorated. So if the investors owned 40% of the company at that point, they would be getting their own money back in a dividend so that the founders could pay the dividend. Or could they do a special dividend just to the founders? It becomes so unnecessarily complicated, but is that what winds up happening in these kind of situations?
I mean, you essentially do dividend or you have to sell shares, right? But it's also kind of absurd that like just for being based in Norway, you have to like sell your stake in the company, you know, even if you haven't made any money.
Frederick, I want to clarify a distinction between the corporate side of this and the personal side of this, because the way that I understood this was your company raised money, your paper wealth, your personal paper wealth went up. And then because of the wealth tax and because of that money was unrealized gains, essentially, you were therefore staring down essentially a 1.1% bill for your personal wealth, which wouldn't impact the corporate account. Am I confusing the issues here?
This is why everybody's leaving, because it's like a personal thing. So you save your company essentially by leaving, because then your company doesn't need to do all this stuff.
So if you own 30% of a unicorn, your co-founder owns 30% of a unicorn, that's $300 million in paper wealth, and you have to pay 1.x on it or 0.85 on it. So that's like $3 million tax bill. So then you have to sell $6 million in shares or $5 million in shares every year just to work at your own company. And over 10 years, you got to dilute 50 million shares or something crazy.
Yeah. I mean, it's on the balance sheet if you're not public. So just to be clear on that, but so it's somewhat lower, but it's still, you know, can be excessive amounts. And
oh, I see. Maybe a 409A, maybe could the 40? Did you have
no,
the equivalent
it's
of a 409A?
Essentially, the like book value of the company
the
that you got. Yeah.
So the book value could be the $80 million in cash, some multiple times the revenue, some goodwill for the logo and the brand name. So maybe you're paying, tax on 30%. Of 200 million or 300 million, some smaller number than the high watermark paid for preferred shares. Either way, you can see how complex this is.
Unnecessarily so. That's the thing that kills me, Jason. Like, it just, look, I know it's popular to dunk on European socialists and the American business community. And I think in this case, pretty warranted, because this is such a self-inflicted wound. All you have to do is tax people borrowing against their unrealized capital gains. And then everything works out pretty well. You can build wealth. You can still have some of it be liquid. You can pay a tax on that as a sort of regular income. And I think everyone wins. So to me, this is just such an unnecessary mess.
Yeah, small tax on a margin loan against your shares would be, I think, a great compromise here. So if you're, you know, let's pick Jeff Bezos and you had a billion dollar margin loan that you were living against your $200 billion in Amazon shares, if you paid 1% of that, you paid $10 million a year on it, or 2%, $20 million a year on originating the loan one time for using the loan. And then after you pay it back, your stock's gone up more than 2%. It's all a wash anyway. maybe that's reasonable. Maybe a 1% origination. Is that, I wonder if that is on the table. I know that I had heard some people talking about that concept.
Well, Norway didn't follow that path, Jason. What Norway has instead proposed is an exit tax. According to BDO Global back in about a week ago.
Yeah. You're staying.
So, yeah. So this tax, by the way, is 37.84% on unrealized capital gains if you leave the country.
Oh my God. Starting, so they put a gun to your head.
Yeah, but starting Payable. Now, Frederick, right? Because you're safe because you left earlier.
Yeah. I left. Yeah. So it's a total disaster. Like instead of, you know, seeing bunch of their top taxpayers leave, all the entrepreneurs being like, hey, this makes no sense, you know, tax us, but please do it when we actually have or make money. So instead of being like, hey, maybe we should just like make some reasonable adjustment, they like double down and introduced a new.
When does that go into effect? And did that accelerate people leaving?
Yeah. So basically what's happening now is like, you have to leave before you start a company, because if you get successful, you will be screwed over by the wealth tax.
Crazy
and
is this?
You can't move. Like if I were in this situation and we had $1 billion valuation, you know, on the last round, and I leave and now I'm supposed stuck. To pay for it. Yeah, like you literally
you have to pay
bankrupt for life.
Yeah. Hundreds of millions of dollars in unrealized gains, you might as well just shut the company down or whatever. Wow, it's really interesting. Yeah.
Flee to the United States. We'd love to have you.
Well, I mean, and I think we'll end on that, Alex, which is the lesson in all of this is if you're bold enough to create a $1 billion company, you're also smart and bold enough to pick another location and you're the there. You ever hear that expression, Alex? The there. There has to be a there. The there is the core brilliance of the thing. Now, the there in Silicon Valley is the entrepreneurs and the capital allocators. If that there goes there being another there, which is Texas or Sweden or Italy or Singapore, like Balaji went to Singapore, right? A lot. And so did the, and he's been public about that. And so did one of the co-founders of Facebook, and he gave up his citizenship, Eduardo, I believe.
Yes.
Went to Singapore. Yeah. And he paid some fee to leave. So I think those are kind of the tip of the spear. Make it simple, make it easy, make it fair is my best advice. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Don't tax unrealized capital gains. That's basically the moral.
And France went through the same thing. I mean, literally a bunch of French citizens became citizens of Russia, of all places, like Gerard Depardieu and a bunch of other people were like, you know what? I'm going to take Putin's offer up and move to Moscow. Founders know that every missed call is a missed opportunity. Customers don't want to wait. They will call someone else if you don't pick up. But if you use OpenPhone, you're never going to miss another customer call. And guess what? It's super affordable and easy to use. People used to spend tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars putting in a corporate phone system. And now for just $15 a month, OpenPhone will give you a business phone line and complete control of your destiny. Want to know who's answering customer calls and how they were handled? OpenPhone can do incredible things like sync with HubSpot and give you AI-powered call summaries, automated responses to ensure you don't miss a single ring. Well, that's all built into OpenPhone. And if you've got an existing phone number, they will let you port it over at no extra charge. Get 20% off your first 6 months. What an amazing offer. At openphone.com/twist. That's openphone.com/twist for 20% off for 6 months.
Hey, but just before we let Frederick go, though, we have him here, Jason, live, so we can abuse him a little bit. How's Dune doing? How's revenue growth? How are you doing next year? Did you cut costs? Are you thriving? Are you still a unicorn?
I mean, who knows? We haven't been to the capital markets for a while, but we had our very humble upbringing, so we've stayed pretty lean. We have a lot of money in the bank still. We've been doing great this year. It definitely was a few rough years previously. Maybe Jason suggested we should have pivoted, but we stuck to it. And
if you believe in crypto and you think the issue has been regulation and overregulation, which has been an issue for crypto in the United States, if you think there's a new regime in town that's going to be pro-crypto and allow more experimentation in the number one market in the world, the United States, then now is a you'll be rewarded for that. You know, I mean, a lot of my criticism of crypto has always been twofold. One, not producing actual products that consumers love and use, like just not delivering products. And number two, just breaking the rules around, and the rules are very strict in the United States. So, and maybe those go hand in hand, no? Like, it's hard to be innovative if you're shackled by rules. And so my hope is, you know, that some middle ground between you have to act like a stock and follow the book, some, you know, 100-year-old regulations, and the Wild West, maybe there's something in between those two. Like, do it the way we've always done it, or no rules, YOLO, anybody's a bag holder.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's a fair take. Yeah, so we actually launched, we had our annual conference, DuneCon, just a couple of weeks ago in Bangkok. We had 1,000 people come out. We had Vitalik on stage and a bunch of great people. And we launched an index product. So we have a lot of on-chain data, and now we've launched like an index for on-chain adoption. So, you know, there's all this hype, there's all the prices going up and down, all these stories. And essentially now we index like how much people are actually using the chain. So we have a metric that is like composite of like transaction fees. So how much people spend on writing to the chains. You can look at like the run rate. So you could see, oh, there's like now, I think last 30 days, it was like $600 million spent on writing to blockchains, the transactions fees that people pay. So that's like a $6 billion run rate. So it's like in the ballpark of like OpenAI.
In a way,
revenue.
That would be what people spend, you know, on their AWS accounts or their cloud computing accounts. But for crypto, so that's an interesting proxy. I guess the counter to that is, how much of that do you think is painting the tape, creating false trades, people just screwing around in order to manipulate and make stocks go up? And is there a way for you with your analysis to kind of pull out what they call wash trading or painting the tape? Because that's always been a criticism that Alex and I have had of, you know, these spaces is how do you know reality? How do you know that there's $1 billion in Doge being traded every day, or if that people painting the tape?
And we have the Dune Index coming up on screen. Well, for to answer that question.
Yeah, so we can actually look into this. So this is like the overarching number, and it's just like tells you something about adoption. So you can, for instance, if you go the 365 days on the chart here, you can make that like 5 years or all time. And then
So the, explain what we're seeing here for people listening.
Yeah, so essentially this metric is a composite of the three metrics on the left. So transaction fees, transfer volume, and transaction count. So we sort of take these metrics and put them into one to get a sense of like how these things are doing. So if you do transfer volume, to answer your question, if you go on the left sidebar and hit transfer volume, basically, and then you can go further out, maybe do 5 years here as well. So this one we filter. So this is like monthly value transferred on chain, but we filter if it goes to the same entity on both sides, we filter it out. And if we only take the net effect of a transaction, so if it calls a bunch of smart contract and does a bunch of weird stuff, we only take, you know, not all the things going on, but only the net value transfer effect. So essentially, this tells you something about, you know, how much value transfer, real value transfer, is happening on chain. So we think the great thing, and if you scroll down, you can see which blockchains contribute to this. Like we have,
look at that. Tron is just like has half as much as a Bitcoin. Why? Why is Tron so
it's
active?
A big stable coin. There's a lot of stable coin activity. So like a lot of this is a lot of you know, Turkey, a lot of like Middle Eastern and Asian countries use Tron a lot to transfer a Tether around. So and Binance
so that's the
uses
Tether trading, where it's just a stable coin moving back and forth, which is people just trading dollars essentially. Yeah. They're trading digital dollars because they're all pegged to the dollar, right? Amazing.
But yeah, so essentially you can now get like a really neat high level overview, and since we have the run rate and stuff, you can benchmark. You can get a sense of like. So I think if you look at if you scroll up, I think the run rate is 8.7 trillion. Right now, so if you take the last 30 days multiplied by 12, Visa I think did like 12 trillion last year in like total transfer volume. So it's actually in the order of like magnitude as Visa in terms of like value transfer that's being provided by these systems now.
What percentage do you think of that is Like if you had to break that into buckets, how much of that is speculation? How much of that is money transfer? How much of it is the gray market or people doing, you know, nefarious things, let's say? You know, is there any way to get more insight into that and to also understand by region? Because the wallets are so anonymized now, the VPNs are, you know, so deft at hiding stuff. Like, how do you even know what's going on there? You know,
that's a great question. So this is the next on our roadmap. So we will break it down by like product category. So, you know, is it sort of DeFi? Is it stable coins? Is this like other things? We also have a lot of labels tagging. So we have the geo of a lot of the main entities on chain. So we haven't built this out yet, but you can, you know, follow the Dune Metrics page and we will, you know, post more. And
awesome.
Yeah.
Frederick, we have to wrap it up there, but we're going to have you back next year because I want to know about the revenue side of things. I know you have a series of paid tiers, but thank you for breaking down European taxes. I hope Switzerland's chocolate is as good as everyone claims it is.
I know the fish is good. The fish is really good. Go to...
Norwegian fish is very good, yeah. You can go to Japan, Jason, right? You should get some Norwegian salmon on your sashimi.
It's very interesting you say that. They will literally have Norwegian salmon in Tokyo. And 100%, they'll have Santa Barbara uni, and then you go to Santa Barbara, and they have Hokkaido uni. both are exceptional. It's just literally they fly by each other on planes, and people like the branding of the other. All right, good to see you. Thanks for coming on and explaining it. We love to have the main character of the moment on the pod. Our commitments, and Frederick was definitely the main character last week. And this week, the main character is once again Michael Saylor.
Yes.
And Bitcoin has gone on a huge run up. All right. Take a second and picture the ultimate all-star team for your startup. Okay. You got that mental image? Maybe the Avengers, maybe even X-Men, Wolverine, Cyclops, pick your favorite superhero team. And let's be realistic. Until you've raised your Series A or your Series B, you might need some help building that dream team. And finding top-tier talent, managing all the timelines you've got, and maintaining quality, it's a big lift for all founders. I mean, scouting for that elusive 10x developer, that's going to eat all your time. And that's where Dev Squad comes in. Think of them as like Professor X, you know? They know where to find those exceptional mutant developers who are 10x devs. And Dev Squad offers a complete product team from Latin America. You're going to get 2 to 6 full-stack developers, a technical product manager, and specialists in case you need them, like product strategy or UI and UX design, DevOps, and of course, quality assurance, all for 75% less than a US-based team. All for 75% less than a US-based team, while being on your same time zone, which is really important. There's no long-term commitment. It's just seamless collaboration. So if you want a GSD, if you want to get stuff done and you're ready to squad up, head to devsquad.com/twist for 10% off your first engagement. That's devsquad.com/twist and transform your startup with the all-star team it deserves. Now, a lot of people think I am like anti-crypto. You can tell from our previous guest. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always had the same position, which is, you know, produce great products and don't steal money from retail. And I'm cool with all the innovation here. But my Lord, the amount of dumping on retail of this stuff and the lack of actual products in the world that actually perform a function for people has been very troubling. I assess this because in the early days of crypto, when I'm talking 2011, 2012, when I first got hip to it, I met with about 100 founders. And I would say 1 or 2 were like really good teams that were actually producing product. And the other 98, 99 were kind of crazy dreamers, fringe kind of anti-establishment / grifters. That's turned out to be exactly as I assessed it, because all the ICOs resulted in no competitors to Airbnb, to Uber, to Google. They all said they were going to defeat all these products and services just by being on the blockchain and using crypto. But the one thing that has been extraordinary is Bitcoin. Bitcoin has not been hacked or compromised, which, you know, was a possibility. You know, any system that could be compromised, there could have been an attack vector, 51% attack or a country could have maybe taken control of the majority of the servers and the mining, like China, there was a fear. And then there was government intervention where governments could just say, hey, it's illegal to do this. It's turned out neither of those two attack vectors have happened. I thought the default case was going to be Bitcoin would go to zero. I was wrong on that because governments have accepted it. And there's been no way to compromise the network, even with so much at stake. So does it mean that a government couldn't ban it in the future or tax it heavily? As we just heard, governments can do all kinds of weird things in taxes. And if you had a government like the United States or another major government get really nervous about Bitcoin, there is a possibility they could do something very simple, like put a 10% tax on buying and selling it or something like that, a crypto tax. This administration seems to be the ultimate pro-crypto. At least they said that to get votes. We'll see if that actually happens. And that's part of this.
It seems like that is. I mean, I saw a headline about, I think Brian Armstrong is helping to vet people for the next administration.
Love
I mean,
it. That's great.
Well, yes, as long as you think that people should be allowed to regulate themselves. I worry slightly about that, I mean, but I do agree. It's very pro-crypto.
They didn't regulate themselves. There's a long history of people not regulating themselves. And then there are examples. The movie industry and the video game industry came up with their own rating systems and self-regulated so that they didn't have the government do it. Let's hope crypto does that. But this Bitcoin surge is based upon regulatory change. Now, it does seem like there'll be regulatory change, so maybe it should have popped. But it popped from 62, I don't know if it's broken 100K yet, but it was kind of bouncing right around 97, 98, 99,000.
Yep.
And this has made Michael Saylor's bet look really good at the moment. But he's doing some really interesting, innovative, slash crazy stuff. So maybe you could tee up for the audience the publicly traded company, MicroStrategy. Michael Saylor has said before, played the clips of this before, like, if you believe in Bitcoin, sell everything you own, mortgage your home, sell your cars, and just acquire as much Bitcoin as possible. And in credit to him, he's been saying that from, you know, $10,000 Bitcoin up to 90 and everything in between. He's remained consistent. Sell everything you own, buy Bitcoin. That's his position. Now, he's doing that. So explain what's going on with MicroStrategy, because this is, to say it's an all-in strategy would be an understatement.
Absolutely. So MicroStrategy, for people who don't know, is two things. One is a software company. No one cares about that, Jason. It's shrinking, so whatever, put that to one side. It's also the vehicle for Michael Saylor's Bitcoin strategy, which is to sell debt, to sell shares, and use that money to acquire more Bitcoin. And we're talking about, Jason, not just dozens of Bitcoins or hundreds of Bitcoins. The company's latest purchase announcement was that they bought 55,500 more Bitcoins for $5.4 billion in cash. And they announced that on November 25th. So that is today, you will note. So that is the scale of these purchases. Now, the question
they bought 5 billion, just to be clear, 5 billion in Bitcoin.
Yes.
And they acquired that in some trading window, which we don't know over how many days they did that.
November 18th through November 24th. And the average price paid was $97,862, inclusive of fees.
Okay. So in 5 days, they bought that would be on average, $1 billion in Bitcoin a day.
Yes. Yes. I see your point.
I just think that's super important to point out here, because what happened to the Bitcoin price during that window? There is a supply-demand issue here. Many people who own Bitcoin are holders like myself, who bought it at $100 to $200. Would it be even more accurate? My wife bought it at $100 to $200.
Credit where it's due here.
Credit where it's due. Incredible trade by my wife. That has resulted in, you know, a very large position in Bitcoin that we will never sell. That's our position. We're holders like anybody else.
So here's the price of Bitcoin was around 90,000, 92,000. Went up 10%. And now it's coming back down.
Okay. But so that means quite possibly that last bump, the 90 to 100K bump, that window, 91 to 99, was the Michael Saylor bump where he swept another $5 billion worth of Bitcoin in the market, because you need a seller in order to acquire Bitcoin, and it is a finite resource, which is why everybody thinks, you know, this is, is the equivalent of gold, right? There's only so much of it.
Yes. And just to put this into context for everybody, in MicroStrategy's Q3 earnings, they said that they are going to raise $42 billion worth of capital over the next 3 years, $21 billion equity, $21 billion fixed income securities. This is their 21-21 plan, and they're going to use it to buy more Bitcoin. So basically, MicroStrategy is all in on using its resources, whatever it can marshal, mortgaging its corporate house equivalent to your earlier point, to buy more Bitcoin. And when they do this, this is where it gets fun. When they do this, they purchase more of a finite asset. And then, as Jason points out, the price goes up. And then the way the game is currently played, Jason, and I know we'll get into the mechanics here, but the market is willing to afford MicroStrategy a premium on its stock price as it pursues this Bitcoin purchasing strategy. So they're essentially selling more stock at a price that you might think is aggressive compared to the value of their Bitcoin holdings, and then using that to buy more Bitcoin, which then gets rewarded by the market, and then they have more capital to play with. Essentially, they're kind of making their own magic here, which in financial terms can be a little bit worrisome.
Yes, I've seen people on Twitter saying this is a Ponzi scheme. I've seen people saying this is not sustainable because if they hit a bump in the road, the whole thing blows up. The bump in the road being a 30, 40, 50% Bitcoin pullback, which has happened many times in the history of Bitcoin. So let's maybe start to unravel this onion. And we're not going to do it in one episode, folks. So we're going to talk about it today. But when we get back after Thanksgiving, or maybe even tomorrow, we have a live show, we're going to talk about it again. But what is the value of all of the holdings that MicroStrategy has in Bitcoin? That's number one I've been trying to figure out.
Okay, so I ran that number, and in their latest SEC filing, they said they now have 386,700 Bitcoins. Okay, at the current price before we recorded, that was worth $36.7 billion, which, Jason, is less than half of their $82 billion market cap. And we also established their software business is shrinking, so it's not worth anything. So that means
there is no software business. Let's be, I guess, it's like if the software business is there, and that's the other kind of thing people felt was a little non-traditional here. You had a software business that built a quote unquote Bitcoin treasury, but it's just almost like, this is almost like a SPAC or something where they had a shell of a company and it's doing something else now. So the software business is not even reported on here. Its value is maybe 1 billion of the 82 billion or something.
Yeah, it's on about a $400 million run rate shrinking. So it's going to be worth, what, 3x? So call it 1.2. It's de minimis compared to the main thing.
Let's make it 2 billion of the, what would be a huge valuation, five times what it's. So you take 2 billion out of 81 billion, 79 billion, 79 billion, 36 billion in actual Bitcoin. So it's two times plus or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which means if you were to buy MicroStrategy, you're buying half the amount of Bitcoin you could buy in your Coinbase account. So if you buy $100 in, if you were to buy a Bitcoin, you have $100,000. You could buy one Bitcoin on your own with Coinbase or Robinhood. I'm a shareholder in Robinhood. Or you could buy half a Bitcoin by buying MicroStrategy.
Yes.
Why on earth would anybody buy the MicroStrategy stock if it's worth half, you get half as many Bitcoin that you don't control and you have no agency over? It's Michael Saylor's determination what he does with Bitcoin. So why would I pay twice as much for Bitcoin?
I'm perplexed by that. That is the thing that I cannot understand. And all the analysis we've seen of this says that he is using overvalued stock to buy more Bitcoin.
Smart.
Literally, I wrote in the notes, why put a premium on their stock when you can just buy Bitcoin? Like, it makes no sense to me. The only idea I have is maybe people are unable to purchase Bitcoin even through an ETF for certain accounts. And so this is the best way to get Bitcoin exposure.
No, that's not possible. If you can buy an ETF, you can buy Bitcoin. You can buy MicroStrategy. And if you have a Robinhood account or you have a Coinbase account, crypto sits next to on Robinhood stocks. On Coinbase, said they don't have stocks, but you could just open a Coinbase account. So that's not true. That's cap.
And that would only be worth, what, a 2% premium if there was some cool shenanigan there to give more access to people? But if you can buy the ETF, why would you pay more for it? And so to me, this MicroStrategy strategy sounds genius. You sell stock, you raise debt, you buy Bitcoin, your share price goes up, everyone's happy. But to me, it's predicated on them maintaining this enormous premium, which is just premium. the market being irrational. So to me, this is going to eventually stop.
So people would short MicroStrategies, But if you short MicroStrategy stock, seeing this other side of the arbitrage. So Michael Saylor's arbitrage is, I use this market cap to get more loans. The loans are collateralized by MicroStrategy stock or the Bitcoin. We don't know. So if he gets that $5 billion loan, mm-hmm. is that $5 billion loan collateralized and is it the top of the preference stack on MicroStrategy stock or the underlying Bitcoin? Yep. Because if it was the underlying Bitcoin, in a scenario where the Bitcoin dropped 50% and we're at Bitcoin 50K again or Bitcoin 40K again, which sure. by the way, history would say is the inevitable outcome because it goes through boom bust cycles. But mm-hmm. if you think, hey, it's only going to trade in a tighter range now, so it goes down to Bitcoin 70K, let's say, or 60K mm-hmm. during a recession or whatever, people need their money, it's correlated with stocks now. At what point does he get a margin call, essentially, where mm-hmm. he can't pay their, because they pay 6% interest. I think I saw go by on X that he's paying 6% on the $5 billion. So that means every year he has to pay $300 million.
No, it's better than that. It's better than that. The latest $3 billion offering, I'm reading the terms right now of this. It's senior notes due 2029 at 0% coupon, but a 55% conversion premium. And that's what I was trying to chase down because you asked how this is structured.
So
there's a lot of nuance.
$3 billion, they have to return $4.5 billion, but they don't pay interest.
I believe is that right? I think the conversion rate for the notes is 1.5 shares per. Anyways,
all right. So this is where we're going to need some help for the people who are shorting this. We're starting the discussion here of what actually is happening. Michael Saylor is welcome to come on this week in Startups anytime to talk about this. I saw him on CNBC and he talks so fast and he's so enthusiastic and it's a little bit of word salad. We don't use the buzzwords here. We're just using plain English simplicity. How much is he paying in interest on the loan? What do people get when the loan matures? And then what happens if, what happens in the scenario Bitcoin goes down to 30K, right? It loses 70% of its value. Does he have to? If that's due in 2029, he's got a lot of time. But what if in 2029, the price is lower than it is today? What happens? How much gets liquidated? And so the same way this could be going up, is there a scenario where it could go down? Because I know people who've been highly levered in their equity positions, and they have gotten margin calls and have been unable to liquidate assets fast enough to pay them down, to pay down their margin call.
You know what? I'm just looking through the financial documents as we talk about this. And I'm going to bring up my dad's phrase again, Jason, that excessive cleverness usually fails. And so to me, this seems like a lot of structure, as we say in the investing world, around what is effectively a HODL strategy. It seems like a very complicated way to acquire Bitcoin inside of a corporate entity when people can just purchase the asset themselves. So I guess maybe my lingering question is, why is Michael Saylor doing this? Why not just buy Bitcoin with your personal wealth and then sit on it? This is also why I don't understand Bitcoin conferences. What do you do? Get into a room and all go, we like Bitcoin, huzzah, and then sit down? Like, I mean, my God.
I think it's fun to hang out with other people and socialize and dream. But, you know, it is pretty clear Bitcoin is a great way to store money and to transfer money. It's not necessarily the cheapest way to transfer money. There are cheaper ways to move it. But of all the cryptos, it seems like the only one that's different, the only one that has this mass of people who believe in it like a cult. And if, you know, that is what belief systems are. You know, if you have $1 billion in US dollars or yen and we all believe in them, you could go have fun with that $1 billion, right? Or let's just make it even easier. You have $10,000 in US dollars. You go to Vegas, people will give you chips for that $10,000.
They will.
Now, you go to the middle of the Amazon, you whip out your 10K, and it's a tribe that's one of these pre-modernization tribes, and you show them the $10,000. They light it on fire, and they start a fire with it, and they cook some, you know, whatever.
Whatever.
Fish on the fire with it, because that's its value, is to start a fire. It doesn't have $10,000 in actual value to them.
No.
And that's, you know, that's what the brave people who bought Bitcoin for a long time have been rewarded with, is they believed in a system that has caught fire and people believe in it. I think it's kind of hard to unravel it now because there's so much belief in it. But I do think that there could be people who are shorting the stock right now, making MicroStrategy go up, which then gives Michael Saylor the ability to get more loans and do in a more audacious strategy and own half the amount in his treasury of the actual value. And that spread between his holdings and the market cap should be, what, 10%?
Max, there shouldn't be more of a premium than that, because as we established earlier, there's no reason for there to be premium. I do want to quibble, though, very slightly with your point about Bitcoin being the only thing of its ilk. We forget, I think, about Litecoin, which back in the day was supposed to be silver to Bitcoin's gold, if you go back in time far enough. It's also proof of work. It also runs on a decentralized, compute system. And so to me, if Bitcoin is theoretically going to the moon, why wouldn't Litecoin also? It's also secure, decentralized, et cetera. So I'm always curious about that. Last point, though, companies that are not all in on being Bitcoin holding companies are still holding the coins. Tesla, Jason, you'll recall, had at least 765 million in Bitcoin that they moved. I think it was last month. And then Hut
8. Yeah, didn't they? They had bought a billion in Bitcoin at like 30 or 40K. So I wonder if they doubled their money and then they've now sold it, or they're just going to keep holding it as part of their treasury.
I tried to go through their investment, their IR documentation, couldn't find anything. I could only find press stories about them moving some of their coins in different wallets, because you can track that on the blockchain. But the point is, they're holding lots of Bitcoin, and other companies are having often some of their, what would have been short-term investments in treasuries, cash, and other similar assets also held in Bitcoin, which I don't think is, I don't think that's terrible if it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5%. I don't think that freaks me out too much. I think that's where Bitcoin's going to wind up in my family's portfolio, probably about 1 or 2%.
Somebody sent me this. The crypto people have been sharing this meme, apparently, on the back channels. I don't know what it means.
Oh, okay. So SBF, Sam Bankman-Fried, currently behind bars.
Got it.
Michael Saylor has a history of getting in trouble with the government. So,
Does he really? There's a track record.
Back in 2000, charged by the SEC for inaccurate financial reporting, $350K in penalties, $8.3 million in disgorgement, and got into a scrap with the Attorney General of DC, Jason, had to pay a $40 million settlement about where he lives and where he was paying taxes.
Oh, okay. So, there you go. All right. Well, listen. I don't know what's going on here. Thanks for tuning into This Week in Startups. It doesn't make much sense to me. I do hope that crypto becomes legalized. And if there's somebody who can help me architect, maybe my guy, Vinny Lingham, or Sandeep, my friends who are deep in this game, but who are legit guys. If my legit guys can help me make J-Coin, I would love to have a way for all this crypto wealth to flow into a coin that we then invest in startups, and then I get 20% carry on that, just like I do on the funds, and people could take 10% of their crypto wealth and put it into startup wealth, or 1% or none percent, whatever their jams are.
Okay, so this is a way to unlock extant crypto wealth and have it go into nascent startups, either crypto-focused or not. I like that. Okay.
Well, I mean, everybody's trying to achieve diversification and seeking alpha, right? They're looking for some way to beat the markets. If you thought crypto was that and you built up enormous crypto wealth, right? Like I have Bitcoin holdings from $100, $200 a share, thanks to my wife. We have these. If you could then say, well, I want to take 10% of that, that's gone up 1,000x, and take 10% of that 100x of it and put it into the startup game, great. And then it would be fluid in that you could trade the coin. So if you need it out right now, if you're in a venture firm and you try to get out of it, it's you might be able to sell it to the GPs, your interest. So let's say you owned 1% of our $45 million last fund.
Sure.
And you had 450K in it. Let's say the value of that was in half or double. So let's say you have 225K, you got 900K, and you want to liquidate it somehow. You're in the J curve and it's worth half as much. We're now out of the J curve, it's worth twice as much in this imaginary scenario. How do you get that money? Or if you wanted to sell just 10% of it, let's say you needed 10% of it and you were down in the J curve, but you needed 25K. You can't really get it. There's no fluid way to do it. You have to call me, you'd have to find somebody to buy it from you.
And you're going to pay through the nose, I presume. You have legal expense. Ripped off.
The legal expense is going to be 5, 10, 15K. Whereas you know, on both sides of the transaction, probably. Whereas with, if it was just a token and it traded, well, you could just say to my wallet, to your wallet, yeah, I'll buy it off you for 25 cents on the dollar or 200 cents or 200% of the original cost basis. Sure. And we could just trade it and it could happen globally with a billion people participating. And then it could be a coin on Coinbase where, you know, you could see the underlying value of the assets and people would just be trading it all day long. Imagine a venture capital firm that just traded 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It would be awesome because if that firm hit Uber or Coinbase or Robinhood or Calm or whatever, then the shares could be worth something and people could get intermediate liquidations in it, right? Or liquidity.
Have you seen the ARK family of funds?
Yes.
Their ARK VX that's investing in venture private capital.
Company. Yeah. Yes.
I know it's not a big fund yet, but I'm keeping my eye on that. But you're referring to this kind of in the other way around. Like do it on crypto to get money into.
Yes. And so
I think that would be popular if you could pull it off.
I think it could be popular, but here's the thing. I think they're doing with that other fund you mentioned, or Kathy Woods.
Yeah.
I think that's some sort of a closed end fund type thing where you can take out 5% a year if you're a member of the fund. So you're limited in your drawdowns every year to a window where they have a drawdown window. And I believe the way it works is she gets a fee that's not carry, that's just a percentage of the holdings every year. In other words, like a management fee.
Uh-huh.
So then the incentive is to make it as big as possible, get your 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 points on it, kind of like a money manager does, but you're not incented to grow it in terms of the multiple like you would with a 20% carry that venture capitalists get. Like we make our money through the growth of the underlying asset, i.e. carry. Yes. Just like a ship captain would by going trading the spice route and whatever you bring home to the queen is the, you know, you get 20% of whatever you bring home and the value of it. This is the opposite. You're just getting paid a fee of how large it gets. So your incentive is to make it big, get more people to put money in, but your incentive is not to get big returns. So you just, it doesn't make a lot of sense for me, these financial structures. And the financial structure should be open to anybody, to creative solutions, with disclosures, with responsibility, and education on both sides. Okay.
I just think that's the way forward and we're not there yet. And I hope that we get faster to it. But I will say, Michael Saylor, congrats on the market giving you a 2x multiple on your Bitcoin holdings, because apparently you can do that now and everyone goes, okay.
Okay. Here we go.
All right. Lightning round time. Jason, sure, this is a new idea that we had and we're going to do 4 really quick. Ready for this?
Okay. Sure.
All right. OpenAI building a browser. The information broke this story. Essentially, build a browser, integrate ChatGPT into it. They're working on search products. This is very contra Google, I would say, overall. And they've picked up some big names like Darren Fisher, who worked on Chrome, and Shivakumar Venkataraman, who was part of Google's search advertising business. I think this is awesome. Curious what you think.
Yeah, there's two reasons why they're doing this. Both of them are equally brilliant. Number one, you intercept searches. So when people have learned, you just, instead of typing in www.drudgereport.com, you just type Drudge Report. Now you've intercepted that and done a search instead of, you know, sending people directly to the thing. So that's a reason to do it in and of itself. Number two, if you on the browser side, in other words, on the device side, analyze a web page I'm on, I can do whatever I want with that webpage. I can do speech to text. I can do text to speech. I can save that page. You're allowed to do whatever's in your browser window. So while a company like OpenAI is not allowed to take, I don't know, a video that's in the browser window and ingest it without permission, they're not allowed to take a news story from the New York Times, as we see with their lawsuit, and ingest it into their large language model. You, the user, can take that document and feed it into a local LLM and do whatever you want, right? So you can remix it. Just like I could buy a book or I can buy Star Wars and I could edit Star Wars on my computer and George Lucas can't do anything about it and Disney can't do anything about it. The reason they're doing this, nobody's brought this up, is this is going to allow them to remix and to do analysis on top of copyrighted materials that they cannot do in their main index. So let's say you had a website that was very protective of their content, like Instagram or LinkedIn. These things are not allowed to be indexed. You can index like a little snippet of a person's LinkedIn page, or maybe the top level, their bio of their X or Instagram profile. But those contributions of Meta products are not in the index. They're not in Google search index, and they're not allowed inside of OpenAI. That's why OpenAI, I believe, did a Reddit deal, right? And they're licensing their data, and Quora did a deal with them. But you can do whatever you want in the browser. And so that's going to allow them to store every single LinkedIn, Instagram page you look at, Alex, and everyone I look at, and put them in our personal LLM. So get ready for a bifurcation to happen. Everything in that browser, the OpenAI browser, goes into your local storage, and you're running a local version of ChatGPT and LLM on your desktop or on your laptop or on even your phone. And then you're merging that with the language model provided. Hopefully I did that in under a minute. I think I did.
You did. I want to add one more thing about why I'm excited about this. So one thing that I've been shocked by is how much I live in my browser now. Apart from playing games on my gaming PC, I essentially just always live in the browser. And that's kind of where I do my work. Spotify aside, right? And maybe Slack.
And
it's
Zoom.
Amazing.
And Slack.
But it's amazing how in-browser we are. So to me, if you're OpenAI, you want essentially to build an operating system. But you don't want to build an operating system because, oh my God, can you imagine how hard that is? Just to like build
Ask
a kernel
Chromium.
And...
Ask Android.
Well, yeah. Yeah. And you know what? How many OSs do we have in the world total that are mass?
Four. Yeah. Three or four.
I mean, depends if you've got Harmony OS now in China and so forth. But like essentially they don't want to do it. A browser, much easier to do. So if you're OpenAI, what's the shortcut to control? It's a browser. And so I can see myself eventually becoming an OpenAI Chrome guy. All right. So next up on the lightning round is Blue Sky. Jason, I'd forgotten that Twitter had incubated Blue Sky back in the day. Jack Dorsey was on the board. It's been blowing up, and I pulled some data, just so everyone can see this. July 31st, 2023, 434,000 users. July 31st of this year, 6.1. And then today, 22.5 million users, Jason. It may actually finally be a breakout Twitter competitor, or ex-competitor. We've been talking about this for a long time, and maybe one finally has come around that people will use. Thoughts?
Is it run with, what's a differentiator for Blue Sky is my question. Mm-hmm. Is it just that it's not X, or is it that it's federated? Is it that you can post there and post other places? In other words, why am I going there? Am I going there because I don't like X and I don't like Elon and I don't like the MAGA nature of it and I don't like the anonymity there and the trolling, whatever? And then I go to Threads and that's where all my if I were to look at all my journalist friends and like people really on the left, like not centrist, but lefties, right?
Yeah.
The lefties are all on Threads, right? If you want to look for Kara Swisher or whoever, they're going to be on Threads. They've deleted their accounts on X in protest. So they're going to be there. So then what space is Blue Sky?
Yeah. So I think actually,
is it
kind of
like an alternative to Threads more than X?
I've always thought of Threads as like the super corporate version of X. And so that's why I've never really cared about it, because when they launched Threads, they had all these brands that were like threading their excitement about Threads. And I was like, guys, I never want to hear from Coca-Cola or Southwest. I'm good. Thanks. Blue Sky to me is different in feature terms, easier to do like block lists and pass those around. But the reason why I think Blue Sky is doing well is not the features, but it's the users. So I think you nailed it with the people leaving. So I'm on both X, which is where I live and have lived for 1,000 years, but I'm also on Blue Sky, Jason, not because I care about the software, but some people that I miss, like John Scalzi, an author that I love. He's over on Blue Sky. He's no longer on X. So if I want to see his stuff, I literally have to go.
You have no choice but to be there.
No choice but to be there. And I'm finally checking it on a semi-regular basis now. So that to me is my personal barometer.
That is progress then. I had an account. Can't remember my login. I'm going to create another account over there. I'll start playing with it, but yeah, whatever. I really am finding that social media is a detriment to my overall life experience, and I want to do less social media. I want to do more podcasts and writing. I don't like the nature of either or any of the social networks right now. If I do like one, I kind of like TikTok and I like LinkedIn.
Okay.
I'll explain why. Okay. I like LinkedIn because I'm seeing a lot of our portfolio companies and other entrepreneurs doing threads about their business, and I like business.
Yeah.
I don't like InMail because my InMail sometimes is a lot of people trying to sell me SaaS products or whatever, yep. And I don't make those SaaS decisions in my organization, so it's a little annoying. But I have seen, actually, my InMail is a little bit better. I would like LinkedIn to just make me an email account, which was what Raul was going to do at LinkedIn. People don't really know too much of this history. But I think when Jeff was running it, he had told me he was interested in making a LinkedIn email product. So imagine Alex Wilhelm at LinkedIn.com, Jason Calacanis at LinkedIn.com just started working. That would be amazing. And then if they could, you know, intercept the email or, you know, have InMail be part of that. And then I had QuickKey. So I've been begging them to make the InMail interface better and make it more like Gmail or Superhuman. And then I would actually use it more. And I would have a lot of my business stuff over there. So I am liking what I'm seeing over at LinkedIn in terms of our portfolio companies sharing what they're working on, tagging each other, and where we've been doing our live feed over there. So This Week in Startups is live over there. And we actually get some good contributions. So I like LinkedIn for business. People are in a business mindset over there. And then TikTok, you know, there are some world positive folks over there who I just like following. And there are some storylines over there that I like. But the intellectuals, you know, and the powerful people in the world are still all on X. And I think it's unrivaled. I don't like being a super router on X as much anymore because the MAGA folks really do target you if you're on the left. So I have brigades of people who, no matter what I write, are just violently attacking me. Like in some cases, and I tweeted some of the DMs, like in some cases, literal violence. Most cases, just harassment. And so I could understand people opting out of X because of the harassment issues that you get as a left-leaning person or even a moderate. I'm a moderate who is socially left. But if I do something that's out of the norm over there, man, I get brigaded. And it's just like, okay, well, now I've got to like scrub my comments for people saying like really horrific things and I'm hiding and blocking people. And then if I put it on only people I follow can comment, then it was quote retweeting me, oh, you're a coward, and then you got to pile on in quote retweets.
Or screenshotting you and calling you a coward because you just don't want to deal with their abuse? That means that I'm just curating my experience of life, y'all.
Exactly. And so that's the problem is like as you get more popular, the detractors spend more time harassing you.
Yeah.
And so there is a challenge I think Elon and the X team are going to have to figure out, which is anonymity and not being able to block. The block feature now is actually kind of cool. I think they have to keep working on it. I would like to be able to ban anybody from replying who has an account under a year old and under 100 followers. Because I would say 99% of the spam I get are accounts verified or unverified under a year old, under 100 followers. In other words, they're burner accounts. And I'm getting inundated with burner accounts, you know, essentially swatting me in my replies. And it does make me want to participate less because it's like I'm there for intelligent, challenging discourse, not drive-by comments. It just feels like if you have a burner account, you can drive by with no cost. So there's more work to be done on the drive-by accounts for me. Yeah. The balkanization of social media or short text social media is a bummer.
Absolute bummer. One last thing about the block feature. I know people are concerned about, especially women are concerned about not being able to block certain people as much as they had before. And I think that's perfectly valid. But one thing I like about the change, I'll just throw in some positivity here about X because it's where I've lived since 2008. I can now see Mark Andreessen's tweets again. Yay!
But you can't reply to them.
I can't reply to them, but I can now see what was previously occluded to me.
And everybody knows that everybody who uses X on a regular basis has a backup account. So I have my Jason Calacanis account and my @Jason account. People, when Mark Andreessen blocks me, or Scott Adams was blocking me, whoever's blocking me, I will once every couple of weeks or whatever, or if I need to, because somebody sent me a tweet and they're like, oh, check out this tweet. And I'm like, oh, I can't see it. But it's mentioning me or it's mentioning me. I will go to that account and then go see it there. I just flip it. Boop. You just flip it in your app You re-click the link to it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of doing what everybody did as a route around anyway, but you can't comment on that person, which is kind of nice. So I have now spent my time deleting drive-by comments from one-year accounts that are not intelligent. If somebody makes a funny roast of me, I kind of like it and I'll reply. I'll actually engage it. But
you
just
are
dumb
very
ones,
fair about that. I've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah. But dumb ones, I'm like, well, you're just wasting everybody in the class's time with a dumb drive-by comment. So anyway. It's going to continue to be balkanized. It's a bummer. But, you know, X is still growing. Threads is still going. And Blue Sky is still growing. So I think I got to get on Blue Sky again. Just like I check Threads once a week. Twice a week, and I comment once in a while. I don't get a lot of replies there, but I have 10,000 followers, so yeah, whatever. Yeah. Is what it is.
Here's the last thing I want to ask about this. Because I think Twitter incubated Blue Sky back in the day, does that mean that X today would hold any shares in Blue Sky? Because it'd be pretty funny if Blue Sky has its moment, everyone freaks out about it, and then it turns out X owns, 40% of it. All right.
Lightning round.
Last one. Big news. CoreWeave's going to go public next year, Jason. Reuters reported this. This is one of the GPU Neo clouds. $35 billion reported valuation, looking to raise $3 billion more. I think we're seeing this IPO go out next year because they want to raise more cash. So they're actually using this as an IPO versus kind of a capstone event like Stripe's going to. I think it's super cool. And I'm literally now hype as hell about all GPU clouds because if one's going public, more are going to go public. Thoughts?
Yeah, Neo clouds means new clouds, obviously Neo, and they are clouds with GPUs. This one, CoreWeave in particular, had very presently bought a lot of H100s, I think, early on. So they had an advantage, and they've got large, large amounts of private equity capital that's been loaned to them. So back to big public entities taking loans. I'm not saying that there's a Ponzi scheme aspect to this one. Or I haven't heard anybody say that, but I have heard people say, this is an all-in type moment for a company like CoreWeave. What if H100s get replaced by something or their shelf space or the demand goes down? So if you are betting on a Neo cloud, you're making a very consolidated bet on AI, on H100s, and the downstream versions of those A100s, whatever else they're making. So it's a very concentrated bet. It's probably been fully realized. A lot of the gains will be fully realized. So one of the things with these IPOs to keep in mind is, if you look at the prices of them, a lot of times when they go public, they've been fully priced, in my experience, or maybe generously priced, which means the founders, when they raise money and they sell those shares, are getting full value, sometimes great value, from selling those shares, because then it trades under the IPO price for a while. What was the IPO price of Robinhood? Somebody today told me that they just passed their IPO price. So
Robinhood IPO price was $38 per share, and Hood today is worth $37.42. So they're back.
I mean, I haven't sold the share of mine. I distributed ours to our shareholders, our LPs. Yeah. I held all my personal shares.
And down to $8 a share, because it went down to $8.21.
I think I bought some more when it was down on the ground. I bought some more Uber when it was down on the ground.
Smart.
Because I was like, well, this doesn't make sense. And this is, I think, goes to what Warren Buffett is doing right now, which is he sold a bunch of his Apple because he thought it was overpriced, perhaps, or fully realized. Built up a huge cash position of over $300 billion. He's going to wait for the market to correct in the next 24 months and then buy back in. I suspect that's what's going to, I think that's why, if people are selling their Bitcoin to Michael Saylor, my guess is the people who are selling it are those really experienced Bitcoin traders who know, hey, this thing boom busts.
Yeah.
I'll sell Michael Saylor all my Bitcoins at 100, at 95,000 a coin, 99,000 a coin, whatever the range is there. And then I'll sell them again. I'll buy them buy back them again at 50,000 and then find the next bag holder. So I'm not saying anybody can tell you what the price of Bitcoin is going to be a year from now, but I think if you asked all the savvy people, if you asked Vinny Lingham or Sandeep Mandra or Chamath, if you asked anybody who's been in the game for a long time, they will tell you the price of Bitcoin will go down 30 or 40% in the next 2 years. And they just don't know when that is. And they don't know if this is the high. It might be going down 30 or 40% from 200K. But man, if you were to look at BTC over the years, you will see these boom bust cycles. And if we just pick the top two, you know, you had back in 21, a 63. Oh, you got to go back. You got to do the max here to really understand this, because there were a couple of boom bust cycles that now look de minimis, but there was that 11,000 and then it went down. Yeah, there you go. 11, 12,000 back in 2018. It came smashing back down. But see, this isn't even the full chart, even though this is max. If you just look at the two boom bust cycles, you know, you had that 11,000 in 2019 go down to five. So you lost half your money and could buy back in. Then you look at that first one in 2021, that little mini peak, even to the left of that. At the start of 2021, you're up at 30, 40,000, comes back down to maybe 30. Yep, goes back down to 30. So you got a 25% pullback. Then you peak again in 2021 at 60. What does it peak down to? 31, 29. So you lose half your money. Here we go again, back to a peak of 60-ish. And then, man, that comes way down to what? 20, 19, 20, 18, 16. So, man, you went 60 to 16. You lost 75% of your value. Then, bang, back up again. And who knows what's going to happen here, right? Because here we go. Is this time different? Maybe. Maybe it never reaches 60 or 20K again. My gut tells me it does.
I think it does. I pulled up the first story I wrote about Bitcoin from, this was April of 2013. And it's just so funny to read. It's like, Bitcoin is currently trading at $125. Oh, just breaks my heart.
I wrote a story, most dangerous open source project we've ever seen. And I wrote that in 2011.
Ah, you win. You were earlier. Nice.
Yeah. And you can see people debating this story here on Zoom. On here's the story on Y Combinator.
Ah,
and, very good. You know, people hate me, but, you know, this is...
the first comment's amazing. I basically said
this is one of the most dangerous, and then people are like, oh, Jake Howell's promoting Bitcoin. You know, I was tracking this thing since 2011.
Wow. This is so funny. So this comment from May of 2011 says, if you're left wanting a high-level technical explanation, the Wikipedia page seems decent. That's the level of knowledge people had about Bitcoin 2011 in Hacker News. The savvy group was like, go read the Wikipedia page. How times have changed.
I literally, you know, talked about Silk Road on this thing, and I made some predictions. Currently, there are 6 million coins at $6.70 each for a total economy of 40 million. So there you have it, folks. I've been covering it since then. And when you know something is valuable, my best advice to myself is to buy it and hold it, because the power law. And so if I had only put $100,000 in at $6 a share, oh my Lord, let's not even get there.
We wouldn't be here today, Jason. We wouldn't be doing the show together.
No, of course I'd do the show. I love doing the show.
You'd be off on an island somewhere. Anyways, guys, we have more coming up tomorrow, including Klarna's financials. There's a couple of things that we want to talk about, including OpenAI, University of Austin. We're going to have a couple of founders. So we'll be back tomorrow for another live show. Jason,
1
as always,
p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific.
Yes, sir. 12 p.m. Central Time in Austin. See you there.
Yeah, but I'm not in Austin. I'm here.
Oh, yeah, right.
I'm in New York. All right. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.